Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents How to See, Looking, Talking, and Thinking About Art by David Sally. Narrated by Eric Michael Summerer. Introduction. Willem de Kooning, who, in addition to being de Kooning, was a genius with the English language, once likened a painting by Larry Rivers to pressing your face in wet grass. Alex Katz is another master describer. His off-the-cuff observations are fearless and precise. A failed painting might be diagnosed as having no inside energy. A painter afflicted by grandiosity is a first-class decorator, while a well-known player of the international scene makes pizza parlor art. Not all artists are so verbally gifted or so forthright, but most of the ones I know are pretty good talkers, except on panel discussions, where their fear of seeming insufficiently educated can make them sound dull. I know because I've done it myself. The idea for this book is to write about contemporary art in the language that artists use when they talk among themselves, a way of speaking that differs from journalism, which tends to focus on the context surrounding art, the market, the audience, etc., and also from academic criticism, which claims its legitimacy from the realm of theory. Both are macro narratives, concerned with the big picture. Artists, on the other hand, talk to determine what works, what does not, and why. Their focus is more on the micro. It moves from the inside out. The great contrarian film critic Manny Farber succinctly characterized the difference in his essay, White Elephant Art versus Termite Art. White elephant art was Farber's term for the self-conscious masterpiece, draped in big themes and full of content. Antonioni's La Ventura, for example. The termite artist was incarnated as the director Samuel Fuller, who made several dozen low-budget, rough-and-tumble films in the 1950s and 60s. A former cartoonist, Fuller worked from his own scripts, using real locations, mostly B-actors, and whatever else was at hand. The crazy beauty of his films seems almost to be a byproduct of impatience. Needless to say, Farber was on the side of the diggers. His preference was for artists who burrow along, often in the dark, toward their objective, more or less unconcerned about what's happening above ground. Ever since Duchamp decoupled art from retinal experience early in the last century, there has been a misapprehension about the relationship between means and ends. Critical writing in the last 40 or so years has been concerned primarily with the artist's intention and how that illuminates the cultural concerns of the moment. Art is treated as a position paper, with the artist cast as a kind of philosopher manqué. While that honorific might in some instances be well earned, the focus on intention has led to a good deal of confusion and wishful thinking. A visit to any of today's leading art schools would reveal one thing in common. The artist's intent is given far greater importance than is his or her realization, than the work itself. Theory abounds, but concrete visual perception is at a low ebb. In my view, intentionality is not just overrated. It puts the cart so far out in front that the horse, sensing futility, gives up and lies down in the street. Intent is very elastic in any case. It can stand for a variety of aims or ambitions. What has a greater impact on style is how an artist stands in relationship to his or her intention. This may sound complicated, but it's not. How someone holds the brush will determine a lot. Intention does matter, but the impulse guiding the hand often differs, is even of a different type from that described in the wall text. Call it pragmatism. As Frank O'Hara wrote with characteristic ebullience in Personism, a Manifesto, it's just common sense. If you're going to buy a pair of pants, you want them to be tight enough so everyone will want to go to bed with you. There's nothing metaphysical about it. Artists have long been involved with all manner of ideas, but really big ideas are few and far between. George Balanchine, whose choreography bristled with ideas about modernity, musicality, tempo, fashion, abstraction, faith, the new woman, etc., didn't much like to talk about any of them. He famously told his biographer to imagine that he was writing the story of a racehorse. The ideas came out in his style. In our own era, average-sized ideas, that is to say most ideas, are easy. Frank again, they're just ideas. Often what passes for an idea is, on closer inspection, really propaganda. Someone wants something, wants to promote something. The hard part is finding a form. The most convincing works tend to be those in which the thinking is inseparable from the doing. The big idea people will always be among us, but are more often to be found talking to credulous collectors or to themselves. Nothing wrong with big ideas, but they aren't especially relevant to figuring out how something works or doesn't. I doubt if anyone ever loved a painting because of the ideas it supposedly contains, though there are plenty of examples of the reverse. And being able to explain a work of art, to spin a narrative around it, does not make it good. Good intentions don't help much either. Would that it were so easy. The late sculptor Ken Price put it best, "Nothing I can say is going to improve how it looks." Sometimes what we call an idea is really more of an enthusiasm, the passing intellectual weather. Artists are curious. They pursue all kinds of obscure knowledge. Some like to do research, and art seems like as good a place as any to show off one's interests. The ideas with staying power are those that intersect with an artist's inclination for form, causing it to deepen and expand, like a paper flower that blooms when you put it in water. The right idea, one that is in productive sync with one's talents, can unlock a whole worldview. If that idea is also part of a sensibility that is forming and spreading in the larger culture or zeitgeist, a multiplier effect comes into play, and the art will resonate strongly with the viewing public. We will feel that it expresses us. A desire to feel that synchronicity has led some artists, as well as critics, to seek out the big idea in advance. In practice, achieving that resonance is virtually impossible to map out ahead of time. Too many factors are involved. I am, by temperament, a little wary of art that too directly tries to express its cultural moment. Besides, what is left once that moment has passed? Most art that projects a sense of vitality responds to, indeed is part of, the situation, cultural, historical, intellectual, in which the artist finds herself. It could hardly be otherwise. But the correspondence is seldom one-to-one. Art that shores up an already ratified position or illustrates today's headlines is likely to have a brief shelf life. If good art illustrates anything at all, it's likely to be a story you didn't even know needed telling. What is art, anyway? Do we need to know? Can't we just be satisfied with John Baldessari's dictum, "Art is anything an artist does," and let it go at that? It's a little broad. The essays in this collection start with the premise that art is something someone made. Art in things was the architect Charles Voysey's credo for the arts and crafts movement around the turn of the last century, and it still has a nice ring to it. Because art, even what's known as conceptual art, is also a thing. Someone made something, or caused it to be made, that has certain qualities. Those qualities are related to the artist's intention, but because they reside in material form, they speak a different language. If that strikes you as anti-intellectual, I would point out that there are many different kinds of intelligence among our species, as well as other creatures, for that matter. And the kinds of intelligence that one finds in a dancer's phrasing, a poet's use of meter, a painter's inflections of the brush, or a musician's improvising, are not of a lesser sort. They are just more difficult to describe. Making the effort to describe just those sorts of perceivable effects enlarges our feeling for art generally. Art is more than a sum of cultural signs. It is a language both direct and associative, and has a grammar and syntax like any other human communication. The act of paying close attention to what someone made, in all of its particulars, is what stimulates an authentic, as opposed to a conditioned, response. Since the advent of modernism in the 19th century, the accelerated rate of stylistic change has necessitated the use of broad, formal-sounding categories to account for the problem of style. Like a scorecard at the ball game, it's a way to keep track of the players. Sometimes the labels were chosen by the artists themselves, like the Futurism or Constructivism. But whoever wanted to be called a fauve, a wild beast, and that goes double for Neo Geo or Institutional Critique, which has all the appeal of castor oil. Most of the art talk one hears today navigates by categories derived from a kind of historical determinism, which assumes that style is the more or less conscious expression of ideas about the changing nature or function of art. We have had a royal procession of styles, each one supplanting those that preceded it. Non-objectivism, expressionism, abstract expressionism, minimalism, conceptualism, neo-expressionism. The list goes on. There are, in addition, the many non-visual categories currently in use, the ones derived from French critical theory and its many variants. Post-structuralism, post-colonialism, queer theory, etc. If the art is a noun, the critical theory words are the adjectives. All of these categories are useful, even illuminating, but none tells us anything particular about what Alex Katz would call art's inside energy, which can only be accessed by taking note of a work's specificity, tight pants and all. So ingrained are these broad definitions of style that it's a little hard to imagine an alternative. How does one talk about art without invoking the isms or resorting to generalities? Where does one turn to find a vocabulary that conveys the savor of looking? In a 1928 essay about that great paradigm shifter Gertrude Stein, Catherine Ann Porter observes that narrative is not the driving force in Stein's fiction. Porter takes this to be a point of interest. Stein's concern is with what she calls the bottom nature of people, a quality that exists underneath other attributes and is of importance to the writer because it will, to a large extent, determine how a person acts in the world. Porter, in a brilliant gesture of critical free association, goes on to compare Stein to the 16th century German alchemist and theologian Jakob Boehme, who categorized people in terms of their essential elements. He placed humanity along a kind of early periodic table, giving each character trait a counterpart in physical matter. Boehme knew people as salt or mercury, as moist or dry, as burning or smoking, as bitter, sour, or sweet. 400 years later, Stein describes people as attacking or resisting, as dependent or independent, as having a core of wood or of mud. Good and bad, right and wrong are attributes to her, like girth or a weak chin. Strength and weakness are real things that live inside people. Stein's writing is based in a highly personal form of observation, and her judgments are extrapolations from a life of observing how people behave, of seeing how things work. The butterfly will be pinned to the board. There is slight difference between the way one wears a hat and the kind of person one is. Only a pushy one would wear such a hat. Only a clever one would make a painting like that. I think Stein's way of describing character has relevance for talking about art. A genuine and ordinary reaction to paintings and sculpture, like one's first impression of a new person, is usually very much to the point. So wrote the painter and exemplary critic Fairfield Porter in 1958, and it's still valid. We often describe certain paintings as old friends, for good reason. What is this thing about art that speaks to us? How to account for the feeling of recognition we have with art, almost as if the work were waiting for us, anticipating our engagement with its deeper music? It has to do with something you can intuit, as you would with any person you meet. One way to look at a painting, and I use that word as shorthand for visual art in general, is to notice as you take its measure what it is you actually find yourself thinking about, which may differ from what you imagine you're supposed to be thinking about. Many people who write and talk about art have no particular visual fluency, something I used to find surprising but no longer do. Extravagant claims are routinely made about what art has to tell us. One learns to sift through them. The wall label might inform you that the work is about the artist's investigation into the semiotics of performative strategies, while you find yourself wondering if the cafeteria food is any good. Of course, art has many functions, and they operate more or less simultaneously. We need to pay attention to what a work of art actually does, as distinct from whatever may be its supposed intention. How does one learn to make these kinds of distinctions? Most of what I've learned about art has been on the run, from looking, making, and looking again, and also from listening to the very bright talk that has always enlivened the art world air. In 1975, the year I came to New York, fresh from CalArts, I started out writing as a way to pay the rent. Following in the path of artists like Donald Judd before me, I wrote short reviews for a now defunct publication called Arts Magazine. The pay was $30 per review. My rent was $125. You could do a few reviews a month, pick up some work doing sheetrock, and just about get by. The magazine was edited by a man named Richard Martin, who had a passing resemblance to Yves Saint Laurent. Three-piece suit, aviator glasses, shag haircut. He went on to become a curator at the Fashion Institute of Technology, where he made some groundbreaking exhibitions, including the first museum show devoted to Claire McArdle, the designer who pioneered sportswear for American women. Richard was encouraging and treated me like a grown-up. I was 22. The magazine wasn't really edited, just compiled. I could review whatever I chose, and I don't remember my copy ever being marked up. The writing was pretty bad, labored, convoluted. Only one piece from that time, about Vito Acconci, has been included here. But those reviews were my earliest attempts at finding an independent way to talk about art. For most of the 80s and 90s, I approached interviews as a kind of lazy person's form of writing. That's what I told myself. But it's a very limited form. Eventually, I started writing in the old-fashioned way, that is, without the benefit of an interlocutor. I found that writing about something helped me to understand what I really thought about it. Writing completed the circle, in a way. Eventually, it became a habit that proved hard to shake. I must have somewhere had a secret longing to be a columnist, one of several childish and absurd, out-of-the-question romantic fantasies, like my ambition at age 8 to be a concert pianist, me with no musical talent whatsoever. I had, at that point, never even been in the same room with a piano. Then one morning I woke up to find that I was a columnist, with a deadline to prove it. It is, in a way, a strange ambition, to write about the work of other artists, especially one's contemporaries. Unlike in the literary life, where it's almost de rigueur, there have been few takers in the visual arts since Giorgio Vasari tried his hand in 1550. Needless to say, when an artist sits down to write about another artist, he is also writing about himself. He is inevitably writing from his own sensibility and must, if he is honest about it, place himself somewhere in the story. Most of these pieces were written for magazines: Town and Country, The Paris Review, Interview, Art News, and Art Forum. Others were written for exhibition catalogs. The notes grouped under the heading Pedagogy, the classroom exercises as well as various lectures, are published here for the first time. No matter the venue, I have tried to give access to a work's core of feeling and meaning as I experience them, and to draw a parallel between what artists do and the kinds of experiences we all have in life, to the kinds of emotional transactions we can all recognize or imagine. The essays ask, in various ways, what makes a work of art tick? What makes it good? What makes it interesting? Again, it doesn't have to be that complicated. I know some people experience the world of contemporary art as a minefield of jargon designed specifically to trip them up. My hope is that the general listener, that is, anyone with even a passing interest in the subject, will find in these essays the counter-argument, that a core of art's meaning can be accessed without a lot of specialized equipment. A note on the organization. The subjects in this collection range from compass points, like John Baldessari and Alex Katz, to historical figures like André Durand and Francis Picabia. Many of the pieces are about my contemporaries, artists I have known for decades in some cases. Some I went to school with. Some are friends. I don't see any reason not to write about the work of people I know well. The book is organized into four sections. How to give form to an idea. Being an artist, art in the world, and pedagogy and polemics. The last section, which might also be called Advice to the Young Artist, contains a number of exercises that can be done as part of a class or on one's own. They are designed so that one may find the pleasure to be had from making her own connections, descriptions, and analogies. Why not? Part 1. How to give form to an idea. Alex Katz, The How and the What. 1. The focus on the what in art has been going on forever, or at least since 1865, the year Edouard Manet provoked the audience with Olympia, a painting of a reclining, dark-haired courtesan, skin pale as chalk, adorned with only a pair of come-hither mules and a black choker. You can imagine the dialogue in the cafes over a glass of absinthe. He painted what? Subject matter, the what, can of course be a big deal. It's also easy to talk about. But more to the heart of the work, the thing that reveals its nature and quality, is the how, the specific inflection and touch that go into its making. To take a work's psychic temperature, look at its surface energy. Like syntax and rhythm in poetry, the humanity and the mechanics reveal the artist's character. They determine the way that art will get under our skin, or fail to. 2. I've been friends with the painter Alex Katz for over 35 years. During that time, we've had hundreds of conversations about the art of painting and the history of the avant-garde. Conversations that often veer off into considerations of moral philosophy and cultural history, the macro in the micro, so to speak. In addition, Alex has maintained a running commentary about society and social manners, fashion and style, politics, and the dramatic arts, including theater, movies, and dance, as well as most known forms of literature. Should you be interested, he can also talk knowledgeably about military history, the best way to renovate a loft cheaply, how to buy a suit that you actually look good in, and innumerable other things. Over the course of all that talk, I don't remember ever being bored. Alex once said it was bad manners to bore your friends. You wouldn't want to make a boring painting. It's a form of rudeness. 88 years old as of this writing, Katz seems to be only gaining in energy, intensity, and clarity. I'll have whatever he's having. His possession of the life force comes straight through to the paint itself. Paying close attention to his work is like attending a one-man art school. All the basics are illuminated. Katz is very, very good at the what. That is to say, he's always on the lookout for a dynamite image, an image that makes of its subject something iconic. The enduring part of his art, however, lies in the how. He can paint a swath of landscape, a white pine silhouetted against a late afternoon sky, its sweeping horizontal branches made with very wide brushstrokes that arch upward to finish in satisfying, meaty points, repeatedly, and come up with different results every time because of the specific physical energy and tempo brought to bear on each iteration. His ease with a big brush, the way it arrives at the image, is akin to the unerring way Miguel Cabrera's bat finds the ball. 3. Katz is also a great colorist. In painting, as in ophthalmology, color is relational. A color is seldom experienced autonomously. We always see one color against another, and those two against a third, and so on. There are dozens of other factors that influence our perception of color, such as value, how light or dark something is, and saturation, how dense a color seems. But what counts most is the intervals between colors, precisely chosen. The way colors work in contiguity creates a powerful chain of response from eye to brain. Just think about putting together an outfit. Does pink go with gray, or is it best set off with another color altogether? In painting, the specificity of color is everything. That orange next to this brown, with a tiny bit of that exact shade of celadon as a bridge. It's analogous to the combination of notes that make up a musical chord. It's the intervals that work directly on our emotional core. A good example of what I mean is Katz's Black Hat 2, in which the colors of the face and the background, pinks, tans, oranges, and yellows in close proximity, form an assertive counterpoint to the jump the eye must take to the dense black of the hat and sunglasses. It's the visual equivalent of a tenor reaching for a high note. This rare alloy of sensibility and materiality is, I think, what enables some artists to transform dross into gold. A friend of mine once observed that you could recognize a Katz if it fell out of an airplane at 30,000 feet. Although always on the lookout for an image of killing glamour, the woman in a big hat and sunglasses mentioned earlier, the shadow a pine tree casts on a country lane, an umbrella in the snow, Katz will sometimes take unpromising or even unlovely subjects and, as if to once again demonstrate the relationship between form and style, distill them through the familiar Katzian stylistic laboratory, an almost completely black night sky, someone's feet in clunky black shoes, the edge of a building disappearing in the mists. Everything is form. We recognize it as such when it's divided into shapes or planes of different colors. Think about the edge of a book. The color of one side is different, lighter or darker than the top. It's the painterly equivalent of a physical law. Where the plane changes, so does the color. And where two planes meet, there is, naturally enough, an edge. How a painter treats this edge is the real subject of realist painting. How the brush behaves in the vicinity of an edge gives a painting its present tenseness, the feeling of the eternal present. Years ago, over lunch in a Soho restaurant, the late art critic John Russell proclaimed with his aristocratic British stammer, "Alex, you are the master of the edge." 4. There's a story, possibly apocryphal, about the origin of Jasper Johns's famous sculpture of two Ballantine's ale cans that percolated for years through the sediment of art world culture. It defined, with some efficiency, the nature of competition among artists, as well as the tidal pull of the generations, each one supplanting the other in waves. As the 1950s came to a close, so goes the legend, the then upstart dealer Leo Castelli, a suave, European semi-snob, offended the sensibilities of some of the old guard abstractionists by his ability as a salesman. This assertion, if you happen to know Leo, as later on I did, was actually pretty funny. Leo, as far as I could tell, never gave the impression of trying to sell anything. But at that time, when the hardcore art world saw itself as resolutely non-commercial, a dealer who could actually sell pictures to Park Avenue swells, and moreover, do so without seeming to break a sweat, was the cause of some grousing and grumbling among the painters who had, well into their 40s and beyond, survived on cafeteria food and cheap bourbon. For this band of not altogether happy campers, the market's indifference was proof of one's authenticity. No, in the summer of 1958, the mood was not good at Georgica Beach, for years the meeting place of the Hamptons artist community, the site of innumerable quarrels and reconciliations, killing hangovers and bruised egos. Now, one could feel the winds of change, so wanted for so long, start to blow, but in a not altogether congenial direction. In those halcyon days, one fine summer afternoon, Willem de Kooning was getting all worked up over this Castelli thing. Draining his Ballantines, de Kooning crushed the can and violently flung it into the sand. "That son of a bitch, Castelli," he shouted. I bet he could sell a couple of beer cans. This uttered by a man who had spent one entire summer using the porch of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?